On a Wednesday, you're listening to Idaho Matters. Hi, I'm George Prentice. As we continue to cover the coronavirus pandemic, we know many of you have questions and concerns, and we want to help get some answers. And the best way to do that is to bring in Idaho medical experts. So let's bring in today's panel of healthcare professionals. If you've got a question for our doctors, you can send us an email at Idaho Matters, all one word, idahomatters@boisestate.edu. Joining us today are Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Patrice Burgess, Regional Chief Medical Informatics Officer for St. Alphonsus, and she serves on their COVID-19 Incident Command Team and on the Governor's COVID-19 Testing Task Force, and Dr. Kenny Bramwell is Medical Director for St. Luke's Children's Hospital. Doctors, welcome and thank you.
Glad to be here.
Happy to be here.
Dr. Pate, let's start with you. You're on the Governor's Coronavirus Task Force. Give us an update on where we are and maybe a preview of what we might expect from the Governor tomorrow.
Well, I'll speak to the first part. I don't ever find it a good idea for me to preempt the governor. So we'll all hear that tomorrow. But with respect to our work group, we are looking at quite a number of things. First of all, the fact that we have a number of counties that are having very high numbers of cases. Number two, concerns about school reopening, particularly in those areas that are having the high transmission of disease. A third thing we're looking at is some of the testing challenges. We have had the national labs overwhelmed because of the amount of spread of this virus across the United States, particularly the southern United States. And those labs are getting backed up, and even laboratories here in Idaho are having challenges with getting testing supplies that are needed. So we're looking at options to improve testing and testing guidance. And of course, we're also focusing on hospital capacity because this would be a very serious event for us. Were our hospitals to get overwhelmed. And we certainly think there are some areas where there is danger of that.
Dr. Pate, could you be specific as far as which areas you have concerns about high transmission?
Particularly concerned about Ada County, Canyon County, and Kootenai County.
Dr. Burgess, you're on the governor's testing task force. I'm going to ask for you to speak to me as a layperson, what can you tell me as far as where Idaho is as far as testing?
Well, Dr. Pate said it very well. We have a variety of options for testing, some local, some require national labs. And that was going relatively well until we started to hit a real big surge. And of course, around the country, there have been surges. And honestly, there's international competition for some of the supplies. So we are seeing delays. And when you have a delay of a test result that could be up to 7 days, you've started to lose the advantage of getting that result because a lot of the decisions that you would have made differently have already come and gone. So that's been a real problem. We have several different testing platforms that we can use, some of which are more sensitive to pick up the disease than others. So we have to use that, factor that in and when to use them. And as Dr. Pate mentioned, we have to prioritize which groups of people we test first. So we're working on that at the governor's task force as a recommendation to everyone. And I know all of the different institutions are working on that as well. So more to come as we continue to work through this.
Dr. Burgess, some of us have heard that in the wind as far as test results taking up to 7 days. So that's reality?
That is reality. It was worse about a week ago, has seemed to improve a little bit, but it's a combination of the labs themselves being overwhelmed. And then also, as Dr. Pate mentioned, the actual supplies. These tests require not just the swabs, but a what's called a reagent, and then the chemicals that are used with the machines to run the tests.
Dr. Bramwell,
there's competition around the country for those.
Dr. Bramwell, what are we seeing locally as far as children in positive COVID cases?
Well, the good news is that for a long time, we were not seeing many cases of children who were positive for COVID-19. I'm just going to say COVID from here. So our COVID cases were for many months not needing hospitalization. Then more recently, we transitioned into what I will call surprise COVID patients. The medical word we sometimes use is incidental, where somebody came into the hospital through the emergency department, was diagnosed with appendicitis. And then just to be cautious, we did a COVID test and it turns out it was positive before the patient had surgery. We just wanted to know that. And so we had a handful of those sort of patients with surprise COVID results. Over the last week, I would say, we are now in a phase where we are starting to see patients need to be admitted to the hospital who are children who have really complex medical needs. They have a gastrostomy tube, they have a seizure disorder, they have had multiple surgeries for a variety of reasons. Those children are now starting to need to be admitted just for COVID. So we've gone from almost no cases to surprise asymptomatic cases to now symptomatic cases in our more complex children.
And Dr. Bramwell, we've heard a bit about this study. I think it was from South Korea that indicated that, correct me if I'm wrong, children younger than 10 transmit less often than adults do, but the risk is not zero. But children over the age of 10 and between the ages of 10 and 19 can spread the virus at least as well as adults?
Yes, that's my understanding of that set of data as well, that the very young children don't transmit well, but the 10 to 20-year-old crowd transmit very similar to adults.
Well, and of course, that triggers the next question, and that is schools.
There's a simple, easy one with just two or three sentences for me to say. All kidding aside, this is a big problem. Trying to figure out how to open schools up safely and reliably and predictably. So safely, I think we can come to a consensus about how many students can be in a room, how can they effectively distance, how can they and can they wear masks? And I think we can come to conclusions and consensus about that. The harder thing to figure out for me, where I think we still need a lot of dialogue relatively quickly, is, well, what if somebody has a cold or a cough or a runny nose? What do you do for those patients? The materials that I've seen so far from some of our school districts have said, well, in order for that kid to come back to school, we need to make sure that this child doesn't have COVID. It's a very reasonable request. But they've also said, so this child will need a note from a doctor saying this is not COVID, which is kind of impossible to say as a doctor that it's not COVID because these symptoms are so vague, or they need a negative test or tests. And with what Patrice has just said, which is certainly our experience as well, that these tests are now taking 5-7+ days. So you, let's say you get sick with a cough and a cold, you go and you see your doctor, maybe that's the same day, maybe that's a day later, then you wait 7 days for a result. And those are 7 working days, mind you. So it's now been 9 or 10 days, and you're probably through the bulk of the illness already, but do you still need to wait for a test? And then what about all the kids in the room? So it's really complicated, and I don't think we have those answers pinned down very well at all yet. And it's July 22nd.
Let's jump into some listener questions. Dr. Pate, Jennifer asks, are there examples of communities that have successfully curbed transmission through widespread mask use. She adds that it might be powerful for convincing other people to take that step.
Well, there are. This is mostly out of Europe, where there is far less social resistance to wearing masks. The problem is that no one has taken a strategy of just using masks. That typically this is in conjunction with physical distancing, hand washing, not having large gatherings. So it is difficult to sort out exactly how much of it is due to wearing masks. But we do know, as a general statement, that those communities that embrace wearing masks in a high percentage of their population tended to bring their outbreaks under control very quickly. We also have many studies about masks themselves and their level of effectiveness in blocking the transmission of this virus. So the data is clear. I wish I had the same degree of optimism that your listener does, that these studies might change people's minds, because there's actually plenty of studies now. And I think even now the White House is admitting this. So I'm not sure we're going to change people's minds that we haven't already changed, but there is certainly plenty of evidence.
Dr. Burgess, Barbara asks about, well, gatherings and what sizes are recommended specifically for an outdoor event with masks and or social distancing.
Well, that, as Dr. Pate mentioned earlier, we have different hotspots around our state that are at different levels of opening. But really, we saw in our own experience early on when we clamped down on public gatherings, when we had our tightening up of our businesses and advised people to have a stay-at-home order, we really saw that we leveled the curve as far as illness and hospital admissions. So I think the more conservative a person can be is always the best way to be. And so I would really try to limit gatherings at least to less than 20. And certainly, you know, among your own household if possible. And if it's not among your household, then the distancing is more important, as well as the mask wearing. And outdoors is certainly preferable than being in a closed space. But again, anything we can do to reduce the spread during a time when we have a high incidence really helps preserve our facilities and keep our vulnerable population safe, as well as our healthcare workers safe, so that we can be there for the folks that really need it.
Dr. Bramwell, Elaine asks, should we send our kids back to school with face masks?
I think sending kids back to school in the sort of setting that I outlined earlier, with physical distancing and controlled groups and with face masks, makes a lot of sense. If you want to ask me about putting my money where my mouth is, that's the plan with my 16-year-old daughter who goes to Boise High. She was given the option of remote schooling or in-person schooling, and she wants to go socially to be in high school. I don't think, had a particularly good experience, which I think is a very common thing with remote schooling during the last quarter of this year. So I think that's a reasonable option, and I think it's going to be our best option for preventing this illness from spreading within the schools.
Dr. Burgess, can you paint us a word picture of what we might see at St. Al's, in particular in the ER, as far as put a face to some of the COVID patients that are in the ER?
Well, you know, we see our COVID patients in different areas. We have our urgent care areas where we've isolated only certain places for respiratory illnesses. So some of the patients that are milder go there. Then, of course, the emergency department would be patients that are sicker. So these would be folks that are short of breath, coughing, low oxygen levels that are requiring assistance, you know, with oxygen, and some obviously require intensive care unit admission with even a support to breathe with a ventilator, which is our worst, you know, scenario that we really try to avoid. So I think the face to this is we all think of, we know elderly folks are at risk and we know vulnerable people are at risk, but we are seeing some younger folks that are ill as well. And we've had, you know, even some deaths in the less than 60-year-old age range. So this is something to be taken seriously, even if you're not in one of those traditional categories. And we really, the other thing we struggle with, because people can spread the disease, as has been discussed, without symptoms, that we really need to be cautious at all times. I've actually worked the urgent care tent and really saw a big spike of folks coming in after Father's Day gatherings or after 4th of July gatherings. So we know that those types of events where we're among each other without the protection or when people get sick.
So are we experiencing that 4th of July bump right now?
The 4th of July bump was a little while ago, but I think we're experiencing kind of a general bump from the variety of reopening phases that we've been in, which were appropriate at the time, but as we reopened, we saw a surge, which is why a lot of us feel like we need to, you know, kind of go back to being more cautious to try to get that under control.
Dr. Pate, Sandy from Boise asks, are there parameters or definitions of what exposure is? Her words, I have seen a definition that exposure is coming within 6 feet of a COVID-positive person for at least 15 minutes. She asked, is there a difference between 5, 10, or 15 minutes?
So, yes, that is the CDC criteria. And the state of Idaho has also adopted the CDC definition. You know, it's a good question as to, is there a difference between being around someone for 5, 10, 15, or 20 minutes? You know, there probably is, in that the longer you're with somebody, especially in close contact, the more likely, if that person is shedding the virus, that you're going to get it. But on the flip side, does that mean that somebody that's only in contact with someone for 5 minutes can't get infected? And we certainly don't know that to be the case. I think it depends on your circumstances. For example, if Dr. Bramwell was infected and didn't know it, I would not want to be on a 5 minute elevator ride with him. I think it depends on the circumstances as to how much risk.
Dr. Bramwell, we've talked a little bit about K through 12. Let's talk about college. Specifically, the cities of Boise, Moscow, Pocatello, and Idaho's four-year universities, which will see the return of students in the next, well, few weeks. How concerned are you about COVID on campus?
You know, George, that's a great question, and I think it's really related to the other things that we've talked about controlling groups, about controlling exposure, and about maintaining your distance. I think that college can be done successfully if you keep those things in mind. I suspect that there will be lots of kids attending college remotely. I have a niece who's trying to go to a college in Hawaii, and they don't have living spaces for them in Hawaii. So she's going to be attending remotely as her only option. I think that there may be some component of in-person learning and hybrid remote learning in many situations and at different colleges. I don't know that anyone has really solved this definitively, because I think that from what I'm reading from different schools, they're giving kids the options of, do you want to attend remotely this semester, or do you want to attend in person, or do you want to do some of each? It's very complicated, but I do think to answer your question, George, that college can be done successfully as long as we keep these other rules in mind.
Dr. Burgess, I'd like to talk a little bit about vulnerability. There was a story in the New York Times that really popped out for me. It was from Melbourne, Australia, where, of course, it's wintertime. But the outbreak spread in part because of the sharing of a cigarette lighter among security guards working at a hotel where returning travelers were quarantined. Then it circulated into low-income neighborhoods in the Melbourne area with sizable migrant populations, and then they were just off to the races. And yet it comes back to sharing a cigarette lighter. Indeed, how vulnerable we all are.
Well, that's interesting. I'm not sure if it would be touching the lighter or the fact that they were in close proximity when they were sharing the lighter. But you do bring up, you know, other vulnerable populations, which are folks that live in close quarters, which I think was part of the population that you were describing.
Right.
And as we've discussed, you know, the closer contact with no mask, sharing the same air, like Dr. Pate mentioned with the elevator, you know, in a car, those are all going to be higher risk activities than open air at a safer distance, wearing a mask. So we know all of these things that can help us be safer. And there's lots of charts and graphs out there that I think have been pretty widely distributed on social media and other places on the different level of risk of different activities. But yeah, those close quarters and not wearing a mask are going to put people at higher risk. And then when you add vulnerability as far as your own health or your own medical conditions, we've certainly seen the long-term care facilities be heavily impacted around our country and around the world, because you have the combination of close quarters plus elderly folks with frequently chronic medical problems.
And Dr. Burgess, indeed, there's the fatigue factor too, of people just getting lazy about some of the protocols which were routine in March and April. But as time goes by, we've gotten a little, well, quite frankly, lazy.
Well, I think you're exactly right, but not just lazy, but you know, we're just tired. We're social animals. We're used to having our freedoms, and I think we all felt back in March that we could do our part, and I think we did see results from that. We saw less cases, but I think in some people's minds they thought, well, then why are we doing all of this? And as we reopened, I don't think have necessarily made the connection that now we are seeing more spread. And the idea of going backwards to being more cautious is very challenging for folks. This is the summer. People are used to getting together. We've had a lot of folks that have missed trips, that have missed graduations and proms and sporting events. And I think everyone is fatigued from lack of doing the things that they love to do. And it is a big sacrifice, but unfortunately during this time, it is the appropriate thing to do to try to prevent us from getting into a bad situation or a worse situation.
Dr. Pate, I've got just a couple of minutes here. I've got a final question from a listener. Can you ask Dr. Pate whether the governor's task force experts will be advising the governor on how to resume in-person classes at colleges and universities?
We are not taking that specific issue on as of yet. So I think the colleges and universities are working with the local public health districts to get advice, but that has not come up to our governor's work group.
Can I assume that you share the concern, though, about a major influx onto these campuses in the coming weeks?
Well, I do. I think Dr. Burgess is exactly right. Anytime you put large groups of people together, there is going to be risk for transmission of this disease.
We've been speaking with Dr. David Pate, former CEO of St. Luke's Health System and a current member of the Idaho Coronavirus Task Force, Dr. Patrice Burgess, Regional Chief Medical Informatics Officer for St. Alphonsus. She serves on their COVID-19 Incident Command Team and on the Governor's Testing Task Force. And Dr. Kenny Bramwell, Medical Director for St. Luke's Children's Hospital. Thank you to you all. Up next, a house of stone and a woman with an amazing heart. It's Idaho Matters on a Tuesday.